Mr. Smith.
It pleases the court. My name is Greg Smith, and I'm arguing for the appellants today. We come to this court seeking relief under the Speedy Trial Act, and I have two points that I want to make today. First, that we are entitled to raise this issue at this time on appeal. And second, that the lower court abused its discretion in granting its Speedy Trial Act dismissal without prejudice. First, this court has jurisdiction to hear this issue now, as this circuit has already declared. As was noted specifically in the supplemental authority that we have cited, the Mann versus United States case in footnote 1, this court held Judge Skelly Wright said that a dismissal that terminates the prosecution, albeit without prejudice, meets the test of finality. And he was talking about the test of finality under 18 U.S.C. 1291.
The citation to that case?
The citation to that case is 304 F. 2nd 394, D.C. Circuit, and it is specifically in footnote 1.
What about the fact that the statute's been amended since that opinion was written?
That the statute has been amended since then? Your Honor, this was the court was talking about dismissals without prejudice for want of prosecution. There was no Speedy Trial Act at the time, that's true. Mm-hmm. But the notion that a dismissal without prejudice for failure to prosecute, which is analogous to a Speedy Trial Act dismissal, is a final order, I think is a sufficient indication that this court believes and has declared that dismissals without prejudice, quote, meet the test of finality under 18, and it was talking specifically there about 1291.
That was finality for purposes of the government, right?
I'm sorry?
That was for purposes of an appeal by the government, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So if when this case was dismissed, you couldn't have appealed at that exact moment?
We believe we could have.
Well, you won. What would you have appealed from?
If it had been dismissed with prejudice?
No, if it had been dismissed without prejudice.
As it was.
Right, but the court says it ends the prosecution, and for that reason, the government can appeal. Your contention is it's not going to end the prosecution, and that's the reason you want to appeal, right?
Our argument is that we did not get full relief. There were two things we asked for.
The relief you want, though, is to end the possibility of a prosecution.
We want a judicial determination in this case that the dismissal was with prejudice. How that affects in other cases is how we would address it in another case.
Why do you want it with prejudice? You want it with prejudice so that there can't be another prosecution, right?
So that we can have precedent, sure, so that we can use it in the other case.
Right.
But the relief, we are seeking full relief, the full relief we're entitled to in this particular case. We ask for two things. Dismissal, yes, but dismissal with prejudice. We believe we were statutorily entitled to dismissal with prejudice. We only got half the relief we sought. We are an aggrieved party, and therefore we have standing to bring this appeal now, we believe. And that's why we're bringing it at this time. Dismissal without prejudice terminates this case. It is a final order. This case has been closed in the district court. The subsequently indicted case is a completely different case. It's a different case number. It has different defendants. It has different offenses charged and a different judge assigned.
Can it go forward if the dismissal here is made with prejudice?
I think that it would be raised separately in that. I think, sure, we would
argue.
Your
answer is you think it could not go forward.
Well, that's right.
We do say this has to be with prejudice.
Certainly we would make that argument, yes, Your Honor.
That's why you're here.
Absolutely.
Right?
But we're here because we did not get the full relief in this case to which we're entitled. It is pure legal fiction to suggest that this case is not ended below. The government and that cite cases that it cites reference the Supreme Court's Parr decision. That case is distinguishable, though. There, it involved a government motion, and it also predates Mann, this court's 1962 Mann decision. Mann was issued after Parr and nevertheless held, as I indicated, that it's a termination of the prosecution, albeit without prejudice, nevertheless meets the test of finality under 1291.
Let me ask you to go back to my point, which I garbled before. After Mann, which held that the government could appeal,
yes,
the Supreme Court then held later that the government could not appeal. All right, Taylor.
Okay.
the Taylor case in the Supreme Court. So, I mean, I'm not sure how much weight man can carry. I understand your conceptual point, but then the government will come back as you're talking now and argue par and say that defines the nature of a final order in a criminal case.
But par predates man.
I understand. So you have par, man, Taylor. And we're left with the Supreme Court saying, well, the government can't appeal. It's not a final order for purposes of the appeal.
Well, there are two separate ways the government can appeal. They have the right to appeal non-final orders under 3731, I believe it is. Okay. But the Mann case, if you look at it, distinguishes that. He says they agree, Mann does, that the government can't appeal a dismissal without prejudice under 3731. They acknowledge that in that footnote. Look at that footnote. It says, you're right, Judge Rogers, that they say that under 3731 the government can't appeal, but then they say separately, but it could have appealed under 1291 because it meets the test of finality. If it meets the test of finality, it's a final order and we can appeal now. That's the point that we want to make. In addition to that, it's appealable as a collateral order under Cohen. It meets the Cohen factors, we believe, because it cannot effectively be reviewed after a later trial. If we have to go through
another. If the prosecution that you hope to terminate were to go forward and your client were to be convicted, could
Which
you not
did.
Raise the same point in appeal in that case?
Why can't we raise it later?
That's right.
That's how the other circuits have ruled, Your Honor, but I
Yes, they have, and unanimous, though, would it be three of them?
They have, Your Honor, but the notion from a judicial efficiency perspective would so frustrate justice. Look, the government in its footnote 22 said this. Since 1986, 22 years, there have been only 89 times they count where a dismissal without prejudice was appealed. We're talking four times a year. That's it. Nationwide, that somebody would appeal a dismissal without prejudice, asking that it be entered with prejudice because it was an abuse of discretion. Four times a year, nationwide, is not going to be opening the floodgates like McDonald was entitled to.
Is that because there have only been four every year, or it's just that only four times people tried to appeal knowing that they couldn't?
Yeah.
The government is citing the numbers. Well,
Let me put it another way. Assume we hold your way.
Right.
There would be no reason for somebody who only gets dismissed without prejudice not to appeal. How many? Do you have any idea how many times per year Speedy Trial Act prosecutions are dismissed under the Speedy Trial Act without prejudice?
I don't know the numbers nationwide, but Judge Hogan said it was the first time he remembered in 25 years. In this
first time he ever dismissed without prejudice?
He said it was the first speedy trial. So this is not something that's going to flood the court, but the judicial efficiencies, the notion that a jury won't be called, the citizenry won't be called for a case and go through an entire, sometimes lengthy trial, taking them away from their families and such, on a case that's already destined for reversal because the speedy trial violation has already occurred. That is an incredible waste of resources, hiring counsel for an entire trial. This is a very simple issue that will come up at this stage. Narrow, simple. Your only question is it an abuse of discretion to have dismissed without instead of with prejudice?
Can I ask, are all the defendants have already had their trials or pled now?
Yes.
So does that moot the question?
Your Honor, I submit that it's capable of repetition yet evading review. I also submit, so I don't think it's moot, but in addition to that, I also submit...
That would depend on a new trial happening sort of immediately, right? I mean, in the normal course, we're able to hear these cases before. If they were expedited, we could hear them also.
Yes, Your Honor, but in addition to that, more importantly, it also is this case. This case is over. This case is final, we submit. We're entitled to a ruling in this case. How it affects another case, it is not mooted because we were entitled to this relief in this case and we did not get it. I reserve my time.
You can raise that issue in the other case, right?
Your Honor, not effectively.
Okay.
Can I just pause? Why not effectively? So to the extent the others were convicted or pled, on appeal, why can't they argue that the prosecution was barred by what should have been a dismissal with prejudice?
It is not an effective ability to raise it because you've had to endure an entire trial. One of the defendants,
I know, but you've already
counsel.
I appreciate that. I'm not saying how I would come out, but I'm trying to figure out. That's done. That's passed. That's already happened. So from here on in, why do you say it's an ineffective route at this point for you?
As one of the dissenters noted, some people will get so worn down by having a trial facing them that they will plead guilty. If somebody does that, they can't raise the Speedy Trial Act because they pled guilty in the other case.
In this particular case, the person who pled, they didn't reserve any possibility of arguing this point?
The government, I don't know the ins and outs because I didn't represent them there, but my understanding is the government did not agree to a conditional plea, nor do they often agree to a conditional plea. The only effective way to pursue this and the judicially efficient way to allow this is to allow an appeal now.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we did use your time, but we'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, John P. Cadiz on behalf of the United States. Just to clarify and correct the record in this case, two of the defendants in this case, Mr. Glover and Mr. Wright, went to trial in January, were convicted in February. The other defendant pled guilty and did reserve the right to appeal.
So all three could raise this in an appeal from their conviction or plea?
That's correct, Your
and
Honor.
The government, the government would not argue. Put it this way, the government has no argument that they shouldn't be able to raise it at that point. Is that right?
Not in that point, not in their direct appeal from their convictions. And as a matter of fact, if this issue is not effectively moot now, it will be certainly moot in about 40 to 45 days when these defendants are all sentenced in May and presumably will, within 10 days, note an appeal, which will give this court jurisdiction over whatever issues they want to raise on direct appeal as well as this issue, which would make this jurisdictional issue moot if it's not effectively moot right now. Now,
opposing counsel mentioned the doctrine of capable of repetition yet evading review. Why wouldn't it fit within that doctrine?
Well, I'm not necessarily sure that that would fit within this doctrine in this case because I don't know that there's a reasonable expectation that the same complaining party would be subjected to the same action again. Whether or not that would be the case, I think it would be certainly moot in 40 days, regardless of that doctrine. I just want to point out, I think as the court has noted, that the federal courts have uniformly concluded that there's no appellate jurisdiction to review a district court's dismissal of an indictment without prejudice for a violation of a Speedy Trial Act for several reasons. Number one, it's not appealable as a final decision. If there were no additional prosecution after the dismissal, then the party is not aggrieved, and so he does not have standing to challenge that dismissal. If it's viewed as a continuing prosecution, then that dismissal without prejudice is just an interlocutory step toward the final judgment, which is essentially what's happened in this case. Moreover, I think every circuit that has considered the issue, and I believe it's virtually every circuit in the country, has determined that the judgment cannot be viewed as qualifying under the collateral order exception set out in Cohen. Now, in the 50 years since Cohen was decided, the federal courts have repeatedly visited what actions are cognizable under the Cohen collateral exception doctrine, and in criminal trials and criminal appeals have found that it permits a criminal appeal on this basis in only four circumstances. One, where there's a double jeopardy claim raised. Number two, where there's a bail decision raised in which the person's liberty is at stake, and of course that would be irretrievably lost before trial. Third, the speech and debate clause, and I think the fourth one has to do with whether or not a prisoner or a defendant would be medicated in order to be found competent to stand trial. Aside from those four circumstances, no other criminal appeal has fit within the collateral order exception. Now, as the cases that the government has cited stress, this dismissal without prejudice of a violation of the Speedy Trial Act does not fit within any of the three criteria under Cohen. First of all, it does not conclusively dispose of the issue because I think as all the courts of appeals, and all the circuits have decided, and I think except for the Ninth Circuit, the issue of prejudice to a defendant from the violation is more readily ascertained after trial as part of that prosecution. Secondly, whether the violation has adversely affected the fact-finding process is not an independent issue because that's intertwined with the merits of the case. And thirdly, and even the Ninth Circuit agrees with this approach, the rights under the Speedy Trial Act are not irretrievably lost if not vindicated before trial. There's no right not to be tried because of a violation of the Speedy Trial Act, and proceeding with the trial does not cause or compound the harm that has already occurred, which is actually the delay in going to trial.
It sort of seems to be reasoning in a circle when you say there's no right not to be tried. You're assuming the holding. If appellant is correct that they can bring this prejudice question to us interlocutory, then that would seem to suggest there is a right not to be tried, be an Abney type reasoning.
Well, the courts have uniformly held that that's not the case.
Right. But we haven't held it. That's why we're hearing the case.
This court has not held it in a certainly in a published decision. I think last year or the year before there was an unpublished decision from a panel of this court, which we have cited in our brief.
We still don't like unpublished, even though you can't get by with citing them now.
But it is the bottom line is that it's not effectively unreviewable on appeal, which is what the Ninth Circuit zeroed in on in finding that a dismissal without prejudice under the Speedy Trial Act was not cognizable under the collateral order exception set out in Cohen. And so for all of these reasons, it's our position that certainly at this point in time, this court lacks jurisdiction to review Judge Hogan's dismissal without prejudice of the indictment in this case.
You're planning on talking about the Mann case?
Well, the Mann case, I think, first of all, the Mann case talks about in terms of finality. If there is a final decision here, the final decision is that the case was dismissed, in which case the appellants are not aggrieved parties from that dismissal. Secondly, the Mann case, the 1962 Mann case, the discussion that the appellants cite to is in a footnote, so it's more dicta, not a holding. And since that time, there have been innumerable cases construing the finality issue and the collateral order exception issue in the context of a Speedy Trial Act violation, and they have uniformly held under the analysis that those courts have undertaken that it's not a final decision that's subject to appellate review.
Is there a post-Mann Supreme Court opinion that's on point?
I believe the McDonald case is on point, construing the Speedy Trial Act.
No, Speedy Trial Act had not been passed.
Not the Speedy Trial Act, but the Speedy Trial, Sixth Amendment Speedy Trial, which the Speedy Trial is the underpinning for the Speedy Trial Act. And I think the analysis in McDonald certainly applies to the analysis of the Speedy Trial Act violation. So the McDonald case is certainly on point.
Was there I should know this, but I don't. Was there a motion to expedite the appeal?
No, there was not.
So that's the reason this went by the normal course, and we're here only at the point at which the trials have already concluded?
That's correct. I believe that in the re-indicted case, the appellant sought to continue the trial in that case, as a matter of fact, in order to await the outcome of this appeal, which is sort of contrary to their interest in trying to obtain a speedy trial in the first place, which is, I guess, one of the reasons why these things are not
favored. From the government's point of view, it's contrary to their interest, but it's always in the interest of the defendant to put off the trial if possible.
Mm-hmm. I suppose, but not if the defendant is also interested in vindicating his...
Rarely does one find a defendant really wanting a speedy trial. It's...
Well, in this case...
Wouldn't say never.
In this case, he wants... They want their... What they want is not a speedy second trial. They want a judgment that it took too long to bring the case, the first case.
And that's correct. And I think as is abundantly clear from the many cases that we have cited and many cases we haven't cited, that review after a re-indicted case goes to trial, a dismissal without prejudice, they'll be able to have that review in their direct appeal.
That brings me back to your four examples of Cohen application in criminal cases were what again?
The pretrial appeal of a bail decision where the defendant's liberty during trial is at stake, and that's the Stack v. Boyle case. The appeal of the denial of motion to dismiss on double jeopardy grounds, which is the Abney case. A trial pursuant to the speech or debate clause, an issue under the speech or debate clause, which is the Helstosky case. And the pretrial appeal of an order directing that a defendant be medicated against his will to render him competent to stand trial.
I think both Abney and Helstosky might be stated more broadly than their mere holding, though, to say that to vindicate the right not to be tried in a court that has no jurisdiction is appealable under the Cohen Doctrine interlocutory. Would that not be accurate? It's certainly the way Abney was described in Hamden v. Rumsfeld. And I think it's the way we described it once in Poindexter, I guess. That it's broader than just the double jeopardy. It would extend to the right not to be tried by a court that has no jurisdiction over you.
That may be the
which
case.
Which would be consistent with what, I'm not asking you to concede that appellants are correct, but that is what appellants are arguing here, isn't it?
I believe that's what they're arguing. I haven't examined it okay. In that context. But
so actually, Abney could be cited as authority for their proposition. I know it's you're not going to concede it's
no,
on
I'm not going to concede that, because and I'm not going to.
It wouldn't be frivolous for them to cite that.
I think it may be frivolous because every circuit in the country has rejected that approach.
We haven't yet.
Not yet.
And I don't think it's all the circuits that have had that.
The only circuit that I was not able to find a published decision on, Your Honor, I believe, is the Seventh Circuit.
Okay.
But I think all the other circuits have.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me try to hustle. Lots of circuits, yes, but in our reply brief, please look. We talk about how thin they are and go through them case by case why they don't address this issue. In terms of the claim that McDonald somehow is on point, McDonald is an appeal from the denial of a speedy trial dismissal. That's a completely different animal. In terms of...
But a lot of the reasoning would be similar, wouldn't it?
Your Honor, no, particularly in terms of the judicial deficiencies. Everybody could bring a speedy trial motion and appeal. It would flood this court with appeals if you allowed that. That's a completely different issue here. We're talking about, as I said, maybe 4 years, maybe some tiny minuscule.
Well, not everybody would have the colorable case Jeffrey Absolutely. McDonald had. He probably didn't get a speedy trial.
Understood. But the number of cases we're talking about is a handful, and the judicial efficiencies are strongly in favor of the defendant. That's what's so unusual about allowing an interlocutory appeal here. Usually it's against judicial efficiency. Here it would promote judicial efficiency to allow this. In terms of the expedited appeal that you asked about, the government filed a motion to dismiss. We fully briefed that, and then we fully briefed the merits. The merits were fully briefed before the trial came up. We alerted the court to the fact that the trial was coming out. The case was fully briefed. We encouraged the decision before that trial took place. It's true we didn't ask for an expedited appeal, but the case was fully briefed and submitted prior to the trial, so I don't think the fact that we didn't ask for an expedited appeal is an issue here. Finally, yes, you can rule with the government. I understand. Look, I know the certain number of circuits against us. They are thin, but they are out there. I understand what it would mean for this court. But here's the reason why you shouldn't go that way. If you rule with the government, you would be holding that even a party who was so entitled to a dismissal that it would be an abuse of discretion not to give it to him must nevertheless endure an entire trial before getting the relief that they so clearly deserve. That is it's not justice. You can promote justice and you can promote judicial efficiency by looking at this critically, which the other circuits have not done, and ruling for the appellants. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted. Call the next case.